Welcome, everybody, to another great episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. We are officially into 2017 now. It is the new year. Right now, as we are recording this, we finally got hit by, I think, at least like the first snowstorm, I think, of the season, at least around here. But nevertheless, we have a great cast for you tonight, as we are finally going to be talking more about the tabletop market and tabletop design. For those of you listening to this cast, especially the long-time listeners, you know that we haven't talked too much about that genre. It's not one that I'm particularly versed in. But fortunately, we have a new guest on tonight who will be able to talk to us about the genre, especially how it's how it differs and is similar to traditional or digital games. And this will definitely be a great discussion to have. But let's welcome our group for tonight. Once again, joining me as co-host, please welcome James Ellerby.
Howdy, guys.
James, it's great to have you back on. And since this is our first time, I guess, chatting for the new year, I hope you had a great new year for yourself.
I did, actually. I had a very good new year.
Awesome. I know we missed you on the Game Wisdom Live, which was basically every bad thing happening at once on that cast.
Yeah, that's what it sounded like. Well, I mean, then good. I'm kind of glad I wasn't there for that. That way I didn't get a chance to share in your misfortune.
But we'll definitely have you on for next week, or for those of you listening to this, hopefully before this cast goes up, and hopefully things won't go too bad for that one.
Yeah, definitely.
But our guest this week, he runs his own board game company, Pearson Games, and he has been in the game industry at various roles and positions over the last, probably at this point, I think over 20 years. Please welcome Sandy Peterson.
Hello.
Hi, Sandy. It's a pleasure to have you on tonight.
I hate to say this, but it's actually like 37 years.
Yeah, I know. In this industry, like, time has no meaning, it feels like.
Well, you're definitely a it's a real honor to have you on here, Sandy. You are definitely a industry legend and rightfully deserving of praise. So.
It's great to have you on. It's always fantastic to talk to people who have been in the industry for so long, because there really isn't a lot of like interviews or discussions with people who have been around, especially as we've talked about multiple times on the cast, that how things have really transformed over, especially the last, at this point, about like the last 17 years.
Yes. Well, I mean, a lot of the guys from the old days are, I mean, for one thing, there wasn't that many of us back in the ancient times, and a lot of them were both in games, and I guess we either die a hero or live long enough to become a villain, you know? But yeah, I mean, I started doing digital games in 1988, and that was after 8 years of doing role-playing paper games. Mm-hmm. That was a big change for me then. And then I changed again in 2013 when I went from digital games to board games. So,
mm-hmm. And one of the other topics we'll be talking about tonight will be how tabletop and board games have also been seeing changes and transitioning. And one of the major topics there has to be how crowdfunding has really impacted the tabletop market. And I'm definitely excited to talk to you about that, because it's been a topic on my head now for like the last year or so. And it's going to be great to finally sit down and discuss it.
Cool. Well, I'm excited to talk about it. It's something that I care a lot about and have spent some time analyzing.
Mm-hmm. So to get things started with, since this is your first time on the cast, Sandy, for the people listening, could you talk a little bit about yourself and kind of a little bit more about your background when it comes to game development in the industry?
Okay. I've enjoyed playing games. Started out as a kid, staying in from recess to play Clue or Stratego, you know. When I got older, when the first Dungeons & Dragons came out in 1973, then I was one of the early adopters that we played. I mean, of course, the rules made no sense because they were completely amateurish, but we kind of figured out our version of it and played it for a while. In 1980, I wrote my own role-playing game, Call of Cthulhu, a horror-oriented game, which is still in print. I worked doing role-playing games up to 1988 when I moved to MicroProse Software, which people may still remember. And there I did a bunch of different things. The most famous thing I participated in was Sid Meier's Civilization game, first edition.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm responsible for the Elvi, in the cities, if you remember those guys. After that, I went to id Software, where I worked on the original Doom, did most of the levels in it. Then I worked on the Doom 2, did most of the levels in that, and I worked on Quake. And then I went from there to, I guess I'm giving a resume, to Ensemble Studios, where I was there for 11 years, working on all of the Age of Empires line, Halo Wars, Age of Mythology. I moved around as a designer. Sometimes I was the lead designer on a project. Sometimes I was one of the aides to the lead designer. You know, we just kind of went when we were needed. After that, I taught game design at a university level for 2 years. Then briefly dipped into the iPhone app world, where I was partner in a small failed app company. Then I launched my board game company, and the first game we did was the now infamous Cthulhu Wars, a giant luxury game of a type that had kind of sort of never existed before. It was a $200 board game, but it had these huge, fabulous models and all this flourish and overproduced, really fancy game. And then from there, I've moved on, and now I have a company. We have several games under our belt, including like Orcs Must Die recently we put out, which is sort of a crossover back to the video game, except it's the board game version of it, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's where we are.
And very fascinating. And for some of my older fans listening, I bet they're having a geek out moment listening, especially when we bring up classics like Civilization, Doom, and Age of Empires.
And not just classics as in like, oh, my dad's old, you know, Ford Mustang, but we're talking about like the Model T here, like the thing that created the genres that are like well known and loved by millions of gamers everywhere.
I was very fortunate. Yeah, he'd be able to be in on the ground level, all of those things.
Oh my God. Yeah. We have a Mount Rushmore guy in our midst right now, like the Mount Rushmore of gaming. You're definitely one of the heads on there.
I got to say though that in doing these games, we had no idea.
Yeah.
That what like at that time, Doom was just like another little shooter game. I mean, I guess it was the first shooter game you could play. We knew it was good. We knew it would have fans. We didn't realize what it would do and how it would change the industry.
Yeah, and that's always like the thing, especially when it comes to game development, is you really don't know like what games are going to become those standout winners. And it's like the same story here from a lot of the big name developers. Like you have no idea that like Mario was going to become pretty much one of the faces of the game industry. And it's always interesting to see like which one of these games do match to basically rise to the top.
Yeah, I will say that we did twig to that with Civilization, because we noticed we had at MicroProse, there's of course a whole team of playtesters, right, who test for bugs. And when these guys were finished playing for the day, they were done. They had worked 12, 16 hour days. They'd go home or get drunk or something, right? And they would stay after hours to keep playing Civilization. So we knew we were onto something with that game, because those guys stay. Right? They love Civilization so much.
And that's where the one more turn came from right there.
Oh, yeah. The bane of wives all over the world. And school teachers, right?
Yeah. Now, with your career, Sandy, whenever we have guests on who have been in the industry, especially for longer periods of time, I always like to ask them a few, I guess, general questions about their thoughts on how things have changed. And I definitely want to get your opinion, especially as someone who started in the tabletop and paper, you went to digital, and now you're back to tabletop. How, like, from your own perspective, how have things have changed when it comes to game development, especially as someone who has been working in the field, in a matter of speaking?
Well, I mean, the digital and tabletop kind of evolve on their own separate paths. But what I noticed when I first went into digital, like you could have like the giant team that did Civilization, you know, was like six guys, you know, that was it. And by the time I was working on Age of Empires, it was more like 60, So this team size kept going up, and then it looked like, well, I guess games have to get bigger and bigger and bigger, you know, everything has to be huge. But then smaller independent companies started evolving again in the shadow of these of the industry titans, because as games got bigger and more expensive to do and took longer to do, it became harder to pull them off, and every game had to be a hit or you go bankrupt. And so smaller companies, the first inkling we had was when Serious Sam, like two guys in Croatia, putting out this really fun shooter, you know. and then with the rise of smartphones, suddenly there's a whole genre where you can do games that are fairly cheap and easy to pull off. You don't need a giant team to do them, you know. And so it's more like this parallel evolution. There's these dinosaurs stomping around, trampling the trees and making these huge games, you know, like Blizzard, companies like that. And then down in the shadows, there's these smaller companies that are pulling off these proportionally as successful, you know. I mean, they're making as much money per person as the big companies. So it's like there's a thicket of smaller fry. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of what happened to the game company with the appearance of Kickstarter, is that small... It was became possible to be a small independent guy and do games.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Instead of, right. And that has been a more recent change in board games than it was for digital games. But
And with that rise, like you mentioned Crow Team, it is very interesting to see how these studios and especially development has really shifted over. Again, like from the 90s on, like as you just said, like it started out with very small teams of people working on games, and then the AAA market has transitioned to
these quality games, right?
Yeah.
Your bigger stuff, more art, more stuff, more 3D, more programmers. Mm-hmm. And by 1998, I would have sworn that no game would, you couldn't do a game with it less than 40 people ever again. But all of a sudden, like, boy, were we wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And these little tiny upstart companies would do these fabulous games.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd sit there in our giant offices full of teams and say, man, how are they doing this? What are we going to do? In fact, just before Microsoft shot Ensemble Studios in the head, and we all broke up into smaller groups, we actually had took our teams and broke them up into small, like, 5 or 6 man teams to do a bunch of different games and see, you know, we're trying to emulate the indies. That experiment never got completed because of the evils of Don.
I still miss Ensemble Studios. I really got on you guys just around the time of, like, I think it was like just around Age of Empires 3 was when I first really started to pay attention.
The last game we did.
Yeah. And, oh, man.
Empires 3, I thought that was a fabulous game.
Oh, yeah. Definitely one of my favorites. I love the home city concept for that one.
Yes, that was brilliant. I thought it was like a legacy game that that had never happened before in a RTS game, right?
Yeah.
Now you got a history you can build up. But I mean, it was sad that Ensemble broke up because I had a lot of buddies there. But it probably didn't hurt the industry as a whole, because what happened, you got all these smaller companies flagged in the shadows. So, like, you got Robot Entertainment and Boss Fight and all these other little things going around the industry. People trained in the Ensemble way of doing things. And I went off and formed Peterson Games. So there's the creativity didn't vanish. You have Paul Bettner. He did Words with Friends. That's from Ensemble Studios, right?
Uh-huh.
Now he's got his own company doing virtual reality games. And
so
all this stuff spawned out of Ensemble. I mean, the giant hammer of Microsoft came down and cracked it into a million fragments. So every fragment was still alive.
Yeah. They smashed the rock and it created beautiful marbles.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's sad to miss Ensemble Studios and Age of Empires was fabulous. And now there's a lot of... We would never have Cthulhu Wars or Words with Friends or Orcs Must Die or any of that stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
Definitely. And I would love to talk to you more about Ensemble Studios and sort of Age of Empires design, but if we do that, we'll be here who knows how many hours.
I mean, there's still websites that do nothing but talk about Age of Empires, right?
So. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Now, getting back to the topic, especially with how the indie development has really rise up, it's kind of interesting, again, when we compare AAA to indie studios. And as you said, Sandy, we have these teams of people, sometimes like less than 10, sometimes even just like one or two people, able to play out such a variety of games.
Doom, right? That was it.
Mm-hmm. And It goes back to a discussion I was talking about like a few weeks ago at this point, for those of you listening, probably a few months ago, regarding that difference of refinement versus uniqueness. And while the AAA studios have certainly mastered the art of refining and polishing mechanics, we have seen just some amazingly unique titles come from the indie space. I mean, every year it seems we get multiple just like amazing games that we always say this, that we literally would not see coming from anywhere else other than the indie market.
Yeah, remember, here am I, Sandy Peterson, and I've been a game designer doing my only, like, since the age of 25, my only full-time job has been game designer, right? Mm-hmm. And in that entire time, until I founded my own company, I worked on exactly one game that was my idea, and that was Hyperspeed. When I worked at MicroProse, every other game where someone else is, and the bigger a company is, what happens is that the guys at the top always decide on the game.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't bubble up from beneath. So the guys in the top, they're not designers necessarily. It doesn't mean they have bad ideas, but they'll say, well, they always like to pick something safe. That's why everything is a sequel or an expansion or a copycat.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm sure that I was very proud of Shigeru Miyamoto when he did Pikmin.
I guarantee
he had to push that through a whole bunch of corporate enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was so weird. They had no idea of, like, what is this? Of course, what it is an RTS, right?
Yeah.
But I'm sure I would love to see. Now, it helped that he was, you know, who he was.
Yeah, he was one of those people that generally would have been.
I guarantee there was pushback on that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Rolling their eyes with how crazy it was. I remember when I was doing the. And this is an AJ Press story. If you remember the War Chiefs, okay, so they'd say, okay, Sandy, you're in charge of doing the first expansion to Age of Empires, which obviously should be Asia, and I wanted to do American Indians, so I had to go through. It took me 6 weeks of campaigning throughout the company, getting my ducks in a row with each different level of management before I was allowed to do War Chiefs. You know, and then of course we did Asia eventually, which is fine, but. If you played the War Chiefs, you know that they're really weird compared to the regular factions in the game, the regular civs. That was part of the fun I wanted to do. But that wasn't that big a change, but it was like all this time spent getting people's buy-in instead of like just go ahead and design the game. And that's something that you have in those big companies. There's a lot of wasted time forming an agreement. And of course, they usually form like a good agreement. Games usually don't fail because of their topic from a big company. They fail because, you know, they had to get it out too soon or, you know, someone else got a better version of it earlier. But the topics are safe and they, you know, should succeed, but they often aren't super exciting. The indie guys, those guys can be crazy in the head.
Yeah.
Right? And that's where it comes from. That's how I was able to do Cthulhu Wars in a kind of parallel thing. I did this game, which is completely insane. I have 8-inch high miniatures. Who does that? Seriously. Right, and they cost $200. No one has a game that costs $200. I mean, that's just crazy. You can buy 5 games for that much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but my logic was that, like, if you're driving a Lexus, you don't complain all the time about how this costs more than a Evo, right? You know, if you're eating a fine steak dinner, you don't say, "Man, I could have got just as much beef at Wendy's for $2." You know, you just enjoy the luxury game. So my feeling is not every game should be an expensive luxury game, but it's okay for one game on your shelf.
Mm-hmm.
Especially something that's like, that has tons of replay value, has all this huge fancy stuff. I don't know if you look at Cthulhu Wars at all, even online, but...
Yeah, I was just, as you were talking, Sam, I was just going onto your site and taking a look at it.
Yeah,
and that's always, and that's one of the things that we especially see out of the miniature, and especially like very, I don't know if I would say niche-driven, but still like very... they have a very popular fan base, like the tabletop games, the 4X strategy genre, and even stuff like miniatures, where you have these games that the cost, either in terms of money or just time or dedication, is huge, but these are games that you can play them for months on end. Like, I know there's people who... Every, like, Paradox Grand Strategy game, that's going to be their game for several months. They're not going to play anything else. They're fine with spending a little bit more. Like, the Paradox games usually retain their value or stay at a higher price compared to other indie studios. But again, if this is going to be your one game for 4 or 5 months.
we had the same reaction when at Ensemble when we were working on RTS games, because we remembered that a shooter is like a shooter comes out, it's a big hit for 3 months, then it's in the bargain bin.
Yeah.
People would play RTS games. We were like at the end of Ensemble Studios, 10 years after we'd released Age of Empires 1, we were still in, we're still selling a couple hundred copies of those every month.
Yeah.
You know, there's thousands of dollars that we did nothing to earn at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Still sold RTS. I guarantee you they weren't buying old copies of a shooter at that time.
Yeah.
Right? RTS games, you get invested in, and you know, Age of Empires, or rather, Call of Cthulhu Wars is a little deceiving all along those lines, because it's this huge, complicated looking game, but it actually only takes an hour and a half to play. It's pretty quick for a board game. Mm-hmm. But of course, every time you play, it's really different. You get new strategies, and part of the secret of it is it ends kind of just before you get a chance to play with all of the cool toys. So you sort of want to play it again and try a different strategy. So this time you're going to use the Groth strategy or something. Next time you're going to do the Screaming Dead or something. And every game is a little different. But the same effect is you just play lots of games and you're doing it for months and people get invested in it. And then we're able to produce dozens of expansions, which you couldn't do at a regular game.
Yeah. And that's definitely one of the topics I want to ask you about when we talk more about tabletop design, probably in like the next minute or so. And I guess just to wrap up this part, again, as we're saying, in terms of people getting invested in these games, especially retain their value, this definitely leads right back into Nintendo. Nintendo games, for the longest time, rarely go on sale or get discounted. Really hasn't gone. It seems to be slowly happening today, but still, like Nintendo, Blizzard.
That is not the norm.
Yeah. They will keep their value.
Yes. People still want to go back and play, Zelda.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the great values I got when I got my GameCube was that I could actually get the disc and play the original Zeldas again. I mean, I love those things. You know, well, maybe not Zelda 2 so much, but you know, the other
Wait, there was a Zelda 2?
Oh my god, that side scroller thing. My son loves it, and we have arguments over like. I will diss it, and he will, no, it had this cool thing. And I'm like, oh my gosh. Walk past that wall where the lizardmen throw crap at you. Worst thing ever.
They can't all be winners, man. That's all right.
They can't all be winners. No, but like the first and third Zelda were.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, beautiful. Yeah.
And people still don't talk about Castlevania 2 either, Simon's Quest.
The role-playing one?
Yeah.
Yes. Boy, was that a crazy head thing. But
Oh, yeah.
Prize for innovation.
Yeah.
Prize for innovation.
It had some really terrible features. Much as I loved it and played it all the way through, it had some terrible, terrible features.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
The indies, you get these great ideas, sometimes implemented with some really terrible idea.
Yeah.
You know? And you still see it today. Like, one of the games I got for Christmas was Stardew Valley from my son.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm a Harvest Moon fan, so like, oh, cool, Stardew Valley, let's play that, you know? And the fishing is just the pits.
You're not
I love, you know? But
you're not the only one I've heard say that. Like, I didn't find the fishing too bad, but I can see
not everyone finds it bad. Some people are able to handle it, but
yeah.
Like, I'm 61 years old. You know, it's like, my digital coordination is... is the best it's ever going to be. But on the other hand, because it's the modern world, I'm able to go and get an app to make fishing slightly easier, which is all I needed.
Yeah.
You know, plug that sucker in and there it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they have apps for, you know, little apps or mods. I should call it a mod, not an app. But, you know, that's something you could never have done that to escape those stupid, the Lizardmen in Zelda 2, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true.
The modding scenes, like, that's another topic in of itself, how that has grown, especially with dedicated platforms like Steam Workshop that allow you, these days, you can just click on a mod, Steam installs it for you, keeps it updated, you don't have to go searching.
Oh, it's not just smartphones, Steam is also benefiting the small producers massively.
Oh, yes, definitely. A quick question for you, James. Have you had a chance to play Stardew Valley yet?
No, I haven't, but it has come to the PS4. Like I said, I'm more unfortunately I'm more of the console side of things, but it has come to the PS4, so I definitely want to check it out. I'm trying to get my girlfriend into it because she was a huge Farmville fan, and I think she'll really enjoy Stardew Valley.
Like a Harvest Moon, it's basically Harvest Moon, right?
Yeah, Harvest Moon. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, it's way better than Farmville in my opinion.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah.
If you get a chance to play that, James, definitely let me know what your thoughts are on it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
All right. So with that said, again, I'm trying to resist the temptation to go on more tangents because we will be here until like 7, 8 o'clock at night our time if we don't.
But a 37-year-long career spawns tangents like a thicket of thorns.
Yeah. But I definitely want to talk about tabletop design because I have a feeling this is where probably a good portion of our cast is going to be focused on. Now, like I said at the start, I am not a tabletop guy. I've never had a chance to really sit down and play too many. My friends have been slowly but surely weaning me onto them with a tabletop simulator on the PC. But in terms of actually like sitting down with a physical board game, basically my only real experience is playing Monopoly. That's basically where my
This
is why you're not playing tabletop games. Now, tabletop games essentially had two huge events happen to change them in the last couple decades.
Yeah.
One was near the end of the 70s, early 80s, what was happening in Germany was they were starting to develop fun family games. Now, before that time in America, you had Stratego and Risk and Monopoly and Clue, and these are terrible, terrible games. Every game ends with the board flip. Am I wrong?
Nope.
Monopoly goes on forever.
Oh, yes.
Especially you're playing with a girl who share their money. Oh, my gosh, right? No one ever, right? And all these games, they're such a pain to set up. They're a pain to play. They aren't really that fun. Okay, so people that play board games as kids are like, I don't want to play board games. Those things suck.
Those games suck, yeah.
We all remember Mousetrap and how that
worked. Parcheesi. Sorry.
No skill at all.
Yep. Sorry. Sorry was so broke.
Yes.
Yeah. So what happened in Germany, they're starting to develop these new kind of games. And they have two features that are really interesting. One is that you can play it in like an hour, hour and a half. You know, it's quick to play. It's fun. There's interesting decisions all through the game. And so they started producing the thing. They started appearing. And there was the first one to hit America, which is why it's probably one of the most famous, is the Settlers of Catan.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
Settlers of Catan is actually one of the worst German board games. It's still way better than what we had in America, though. Mm-hmm. So it was a big hit.
Ah.
Then you have games like Puerto Rico, Agricola. All these others, and suddenly there's these games that are quick to play. You can play it over lunch. We did at Ensemble Studios. We were, in fact, a lot of the features of Age of Empires 3 was from our board game group that we had at lunch. We were trying out these new things. Oh, cool, victory points. What can we do those for, you know? So these fun German games come over. Suddenly there's this huge variety of interesting games. Ticket to Ride, where you're placing little colored trains on a map. And again, it's quick. It's fun. You're trading. You're talking to other players. Bonanza, where you're raising bean farms. Also, another they're all small production things. Like the guys that did Bonanza weren't this giant corporation. It's just a few guys that. So, when I teach about designing board games or designing games at the university, which I still show up at as a volunteer, I'll say, "So, what do you think of this game, Bonanza?" I make them play it, and they're like, "Well, I kind of liked it." I said, "Would it be better if it was dragons instead of bean fields?" Then I always use a huge argument whether it'd be better with dragons. Right, same exact game. So anyway, so this happens. So there's all these fun board games, and this huge population of board gamers started to appear. Mm-hmm. And people that hadn't experienced these new board games still thought about board games like you do: Monopoly, Clue, Risk. Nobody wants to play those, right? They're terrible. But these new games are pretty fun. There's a lot of action. You're bidding with other players. You're trading. You're arguing with them. You're smack-talking them down, just like in a shooter. You know, it's all those.
It's
face-to-face, you know, poking them in the eye and playing the things. You're laying down your Modern Art, for example, is a game where I have felt more bitterness than any shooter. You know, when someone plays the wrong card, they go, "Oh, you suck."
Yeah.
You know? But so then the next thing that happened was games got bigger, more produced, lots more stuff, and then Kickstarter comes in. And this was the next big change, because what happened was that with computer games, for a while in the mid-90s at least, if you were a small team, you couldn't do a game. You needed to have a giant team to do a game, so that small companies had to do mods or something, right? That's all they could do. But eventually they started gaining the ability to do their own games. Well, what happened with Kickstarter is that I think it was 2010, there was $3 million in board games on Kickstarter. The next year there was like 10 million or 7 million. Then the next year it was 50 million. And now it's one of the biggest parts of Kickstarter.
Yes.
And so what happens is that a guy with a vision can go on Kickstarter, and there's two treasures you get off Kickstarter. First, and one that a lot of people forget, is that you'll know if people want your game. Because if you put your vision up there with all your stuff and it fails, that's a gift straight from heaven to know, don't do this game. No one wants to do your game about pest control, right? About half my Kickstarters have been flops, and I love it when I get a flop, because I know that, not don't follow up on that. Do something else. Go down a different rabbit hole. And the other thing that happens, though, if it succeeds, you get enough money to produce the game up front. Whereas with a normal board game, you have to pay to produce it and do the art and do all the stuff and then pay, and then like go in the hole, in your house, right? Take out a loan, whatever you're doing. And of course, you can't do that because you're some guy like has a day job. Right. So you have to go to a company, then they have to review it. And it's the same exact thing that the giant board game, video game companies do, which is, was that it wasn't invented here. Why should we do your game? You know, and besides, we have to go through eight layers of management to review it. But you could have some crazy game. And my principle of game design is that if there's something I really like, then there's probably going to be other people out there
that like it.
Crazy like me who will also like it. And that's how I did Cthulhu Wars. I think there's people that are going to want a huge, overproduced, super fancy, fabulous Cthulhu game by me, who did the very first Cthulhu game ever. That was my other plus I had, right? And it turned out that there were, and I got millions of it. Of course, I don't keep pocket all the millions. It goes into producing the game. But the game's produced ahead of time. I can pay for all that stuff up front. It's really nice. I can actually do the game. I don't need a giant game company to support me. I do it on my own. I know that the people like it, and I know about how many to produce. Because I know how many people bought it. I mean, I can produce more than that to sell in stores, but I know it's not going to be 10 times that many. 100 times that many. It's like, oh, well, you know, I got like 6,000 guys bought it. I guess I'll produce 10, 15,000, you know?
And for those of you listening to this cast, we did a podcast like 2-3 years ago, myself and Anthony Conta, I think from, I want to say Island Officials. I always forget his studio. He does physical card games. The tabletop card game genre, and we had an entire cast about the challenges of making physical goods or physical games like that and the logistics that go into it. And one of the things about Kickstarter, again, as you just said, Sandy, is that it gives you a pretty good estimate of how many copies you need to print out or get manufactured. And that is huge when you're dealing with physical goods like that. Because, again, you can easily kill yourself by saying, I'm going to manufacture 60,000 copies, but only 10,000 of those get sold.
Yeah, I remember way back in the, I guess it was the late 80s, TSR, the company that did D&D, they produced a Honeymooners game. And they were like super excited. They got the rights to the Honeymooners. Who, I mean, no one cares about the Honeymooners, right? But grandmas cared about it, so they bought it for their kids. So they sold a million copies of the Honeymooners. But they produced 3 million. And then once they were on Christmas trees all over America, nobody wanted any more Honeymooners games. And so they actually lost millions of dollars on producing the Honeymooners because, like, nobody wanted it. Or we all remember E.T. for the Atari. They produced more consoles, more copies of this than there were consoles? That's crazy. That was, of course, madness. But that kind of thing can happen, but it won't with Kickstarter. Because you know. You have to go crazy. Like, you have to be actively... like wrong-headed to blow it, you know.
Definitely. And you're basically being funded by your target audience, like
your most loyal fans, who will then go out and they'll evangelize for you.
They're waiting to buy. They're waiting to get it, and they're waiting because they want it.
Now, one of the risks you have, and this is not to be ignored, is that when you finally produce the game, like they hate it because you screwed the pooch. So you have to actually do...
Mighty number 9.
Yeah, exactly. And so you have to do the right game. You have to do the game they expect. You have to manage their expectations, and they have very delicate feelings, it turns out. So we are constantly, maybe not babying them is the wrong word, but responding to them much more than when you work for a giant company that produces the games. You don't have to respond to them. Because in Kickstarter, they're effectively investigators in your game. Investors. So you have to keep them happy. But if I produce Fantasy Flight, one of the big board game companies that produces a game, they don't have to keep... I mean, they want more sales, but they don't have to... They don't have to be something they're not.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it's not something I'm not. They have to... That was the wrong way of putting it, but you know what I mean. So
yeah,
so
like
instead of trying to fix that, I will just leave it as it stands.
Yeah, it's the idea that, like, in traditional game development, especially the major studios, you can go dark for months or even a year at a time. You know, you don't need to tell your fans every single thing that you're doing. But one of the things that we've really seen is, like, transparency has become a major component, especially, as we talked about a few minutes ago, with the indie market.
Yes, and my company has got kind of a reputation of being super responsive, which has given us success, but also means that we are that is now our reputation, and we must deal with it. And so when we don't respond for a bit, you have to go on and say, well, we're doing an update. We don't really have much to say because, like, nothing has happened. We're just waiting for Shiny to finish making the plastic models, you know, but we still have to do an update because, you know, because we haven't done one for a few weeks.
Yeah. And, like, that is definitely a topic in of itself about the challenges, especially from the independent scene with trying to manage and keep your fan base happy. Because, as you're no doubt aware, Sandy, crowdfunded projects can pretty much live or die based on how happy your fan base is. If they get pissed off at you, it can easily doom any one of these projects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we try to figure out what a certain game will do, but then there's games come along all the time that do so differently that we start to say, maybe there's not a standard way they go. They just, you know, you look at how Kingdom Death Monster 1.5, yes. They got $10 million, and they've straight up said they aren't going to ship this thing until 2020. Whew. So, you know, I'm like, well, I like Kingdom Death Monster, and I'm not sure I want to invest in a game for 3 years, you know, but they got 17,000 people that are doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I'm not in the majority there.
Yeah,
and then you have games like Load where they were losing investors for the last half of the project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we were just talking about that Kingdom game on our live show. For those of you listening to this cast, it will probably be a few weeks. But for you guys, it was pretty much our last week's live show. We were talking about this. And
did you have Adam on?
No, we were just, I had a friend on, Robert Leach from Indie Voyage, and we were just talking about, that just popped up as kind of like the news of the week, because people were saying, you know, this is like the highest funded Kickstarter projects.
Oh, yeah. Well, we know the guy that did it. In fact, we gave him some help on shipping and gave him some advice, and, when he found out how much it was cost to ship, I remember he almost had a panic attack, because he actually lost his shirt on the first Kingdom Death. He lost money on that. This one, hopefully, like he will, you know, more than make it back. But
yeah, and that's definitely.
But he overpromised, didn't know how much it would cost, and that's what happens. You know, it kind of happened to us in Cthulhu Wars, where in the first Cthulhu Wars, you barely broke even.
Yeah, and that's what I was talking to Anthony about a few years ago. With again, like you, the challenge of getting logistics around shipping your game or shipping your physical goods, if you're not, you know, keeping an eye on that can easily kill your project with everything from international shipping, how, you know, where it's coming from. He talked about how, like, one of his games, like, there's, like, a strike in a country at one of the ports, and that caused a delay in his game, and that cost him money.
Yeah, last game we were having produced, that Korean company went out of business.
Yeah.
Suddenly our products were all, like, I assume going down giant whirlpools in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, you know.
Yeah.
But the thing, other thing you got to remember though with Kickstarter is that when you have these small indie companies doing things, and this also applies to digital production.
Yeah.
When you get a small indie team, one of the drawbacks of that is you have a bunch of guys who are complete novices at this. They're amateurs. They do not know what to do, what costs should be, what prices should be, and they can make mistakes that a giant company would not.
Yeah, definitely. And we definitely see that with, like, from the digital point of view. Like, I've spoken to developers who, like, they, like, have, like, very little experience with PR. They don't know how to get their game out the door. They don't understand, you know, talking to the press. And again, like, for, like, major studios, you have teams, you have dedicated PR companies, and again, like, these are one of those things that for a lot of people entering the industry for the first time, you don't really think about this stuff until it comes back to bite you when it finally happens.
Yeah, exactly. And this is how this, I mean, that's how it is for all the small companies. We had to learn everything by making mistakes in our board game company. But I remember doing it back when I went from Microprose, which is a fairly big company, actually had a marketing department and a sales department, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I went to id Software, and we were a bunch of guys that didn't know anything except how to make games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. And that's where we get, like, where you end up with eventually John Romero doing his ad campaign. He's going to make you his bitch, that kind of thing. Right? And all this crazy stuff. In retrospect, I mean, we lucked out that we had a game that was so strong it could survive us being crazy.
Yeah.
John Carmack is like, he insisted on doing a game for the Jaguar, which probably sold 3 copies. Spent months working on the Jaguar version of Doom.
Yeah, and it, like, that's like, I also hear that from other independent studios as well. Like, I saw in 2 Arkane Games a few times, who, of course, made the immensely popular AI Wars. And that one game has pretty much kept them going for, I can't even remember when it first came, but like, when I spoke
to Chris, everything else has sort of failed for them, right?
I'm sorry?
So everything else has sort of failed or only been,
yeah, like they've either like barely broke even or may have turned like a small profit, but AI Wars, like the strength of that game has been what's kept Arkane Games going. And again, it's very challenging. I mean, for yourself, Stan, again, as someone who's been in the industry for so long, you, of course, know the challenges of sustaining a studio for years on end. Like, there are, when we look at,
you get trapped in the cycle, in a sense. So, like, Ensemble Studios, we do Age of Empires 1, everyone loves it. They do Age of Empires 2, which we spent more effort on, did more stuff, and everyone loved that. Then Age of Empires 3, where our explicit goal was, we are going to win the award for best graphics, which was something to shoot for an RTS game that was unheard of, right? Mm-hmm. And we got the award, okay, best graphics. And then every project had more people and took longer, and there was more false steps early on, and then it was like this bigger, bigger thing. Every game had to be this bigger and bigger thing, and eventually that's got, somewhere it's got to give.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. And
that's kind of the trap you fall into.
Mm-hmm. And just what I was saying, my point is that, like, when we think about the game industry, like, in the grand scheme of things, there are very few studios who last into the decades. I mean, we, of course, can mention, like, Nintendo and Blizzard, but as we pointed out a few minutes ago, they are more the exceptions to the rule than anything else. For a lot of studios, we don't talk about too many studios, like, going to, like, you know, 5 years strong or even 10 years strong in a lot of cases.
Damn. No, I agree. I mean, we were very proud of Ensemble last. I mean, Ensemble died before its time because it never did a game that sold less than 1 million copies, right?
Mm-hmm.
It really wasn't failing financially.
Yeah.
But even so, I mean, you look at Nintendo or Blizzard, and it's like, well, let's compare it to like real companies in the right before, like GM.
Mm-hmm.
Or Hostess or something. And like, it's like, well, okay, I mean, we're nothing compared to those guys as far as maybe in financially, but not in terms of longevity.
Yeah.
If you work in the game industry, you better be ready to move.
Yeah.
You know, so I started out in California, and then my next job was in Maryland, and then my next job was in Texas. Mm-hmm. And so I had to like move all around the country. And then in Texas, my wife sent down a taproot 30 feet deep and said, we are going to be in Texas forever, so I must only have jobs here.
And that's one of the great things about the independent space these days is the fact that you don't need a massive studio. You don't need office space and the vast majority of examples to produce a game. As long as you have internet access and a computer, you know, you can have a team of 3-4 people working around the world essentially to make a game.
It's true. Literally half my staff is in Washington. The other half is in Texas. Plus, I have a guy in Germany and another guy in France. So,
And before we get even more off topic, because I know I can definitely feel this is going to be one of those longer casts just by hearing the three of us talk, but I definitely want to pick your brain a little bit more about tabletop versus digital design.
Yes.
And
like
I said, like, I'm still, like, I have very little experience. James, I think when we last spoke, like, there's just two of us, you've probably have played more tabletop games than I have.
Oh, right? Yeah. I grew up playing the old Milton Bradleys and the Parcheesis and stuff. And now, like I said, I'm usually gaming every card game, tabletop games. That's my jam. Heck, I even tried to make a tabletop game and stuff. So, like, that is definitely something I love and enjoy, and I love to just hear somebody, a legend like yourself, talk about it, Sandy.
So. All right. So,
okay, well,
I guess I just want to get my first question out for you, Sandy. And this is one that I've been curious about, and I'm sure for developers and enthusiasts listening, especially the first timers, they're probably curious about this as well. And this was a question that I was talking to you about before the cast. From a design point of view or a design philosophy point of view, are there any like unique or major differences between thinking of a digital game versus designing a tabletop game?
They are extremely different in the way it works. And both of them have the goal of you're trying to make something fun for someone else. Okay? But when you're doing a digital, one of the most obvious differences is that when you're doing a digital game, that it takes you months or years to produce it, even at a small studio, it takes quite a while to put out the game, right? Well, I can literally work for a month, and I will have a first draft of a tabletop game that we can play. You know, that won't happen with digital. It's 6 months before we have something to play.
Yeah.
And Ensemble Studios was extremely focused on getting a version of the game you could play out as early as possible. We typically play tested our games for a year or more. That's why they were so evenly balanced. You know, as much more than most other companies are like 3 months, 2 months, whatever. But we were a year and a half, a year. But even so, it took longer to get the game. My digital games, my tabletop games are a lot quicker. So that means that over the course of a year, like right now, I'm kind of working on four different games at the same time. Okay, that would never happen on in this year.
Yeah.
Well, if I was in the digital world, I would work on one game for 2 years. You know, so if you are like have attention deficit order, it's way better in the tabletop game because you get to change what you're doing all the time.
Yeah.
Another difference is that in the digital world, if you're a game designer in a digital game, you're a game designer in that your only job is game design, but you are not the only game designer, because even if it's a tiny, tiny team, the programmer is designing parts of the game too, the artist is designing parts of the game, your producer, if you have one, is designing parts of the game. Everyone is a designer. You're just the only guy that only does design. The producer is spending 15% of time on design, artist spending 40% of time on design. And if you have a bigger team, everyone's participating in the design, and you're managing this giant group process of this whole team of people putting together this design that has to change and alter based on what the programmer can do, what the artist can do. I mean, I will take feed from my artist as a tabletop gamer. I don't have to take feed from the programmer, so I don't have one. You know. But the artist's feed is not as is often more productive than it was sometimes in digital game the artists are like really useful, and sometimes they're not. I'll just put it that way. The better game companies have artists that are assets that are looking for ways to do fun things and change the game and make it better. And the games that are death marches shouldn't have artists who are naysayers that are shooting down ideas because it's too hard. You know, let me give you one example. Id Software had artists who were totally productive in the early years, at least. Okay, so for example, I came up with the idea of having these skulls that were the lost souls that would that would do things to you. But I was having them sit in the corner of the room and shriek at you and shoot darts. And one of the artists said, "Nah, let's make them flaming comets that crash in on you and slam into you." And that was such a great idea. Like immediately, we adopted that. And then it made all the sense. You remember, like, those are the worst things ever when you have a rocket launcher out, right? Because it's gonna you're gonna blow up the rocket launcher right in your face, because they always streak and charge just when you fire the rocket launcher. And that was a huge, huge improvement, and it came directly from the work from the artists. You know, but also you have things like John Carmack would say, "Hey, I made this new thing where you're able to make the ceiling a different color from the floor. So I want you to use that somehow in a level," and we have to figure out how to fit it in. And that wasn't always as productive. Sometimes it was, but the point is that there's this group gestalt of everyone going together on the project. So when it comes out, everyone has participated. In some ways, that's good, right? In some ways, there's difficulties in it because it's never one guy's thing. But in the board game, when I like Through the Wars is, you know, 90% me, 10% the other people helping out with it, right? And so I'm not saying that it's better in the board game. It's just different. On the other hand, having games take less time to do is absolutely just better.
Now, Sandy, when you're in charge of leading a video game studio, do you find yourself like controlling it more like you would a tabletop, like collaborative room? Like in the way that you deal with the other people that you're working with.
What I find is that I did video game first, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when I moved to board gaming, I've talked to other board game designers, and I am kind of out in the boondocks in the way I design, because I design it more like a video game designer.
Mm-hmm. Ah, okay, so reverse.
I brought the board game, the video game stuff over.
Okay.
Where like in video gaming, you participate you watch every single playtest. You don't just sit there and get feed. You're there at mm-hmm. the playtest, watching what they do, understanding what they do. At least at Ensemble Studios, we did, right?
Yeah.
So we had a very involved playtest team. Most board game designers send out their games for blind testing, and they just get what the guy says, and they have no idea of knowing what went wrong in the game, or it's just a different thing. Another is that in video gaming, one of the very important jobs of a game designer, and I mean this without any comedy at all, is to be the cheerleader for the game.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Keep everyone happy and excited and positive about the game and going for it, especially because all programmers get all day long is someone coming by them with a bug.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you suck because I have this bug. So programmers tend to get kind of pessimistic and downcast, right? And then artists get pessimistic and downcast because the art takes a long time to go in the game. When it goes in, it's broken, and they have to change their things. And, oh, we just changed the colors. And so the game designer says, no, this is going to be great. What you've done is awesome. We literally go to the programmers and artists and buck them up emotionally, right? And not a lot of game designers talk about that aspect of the job, but it's a real aspect of the job. And so I do this in the board game thing, too. More than most of the board gamers do it. They're more businesslike, and I'm like, hey, let's all make a fun game together, team, kind of thing. That's kind of has gone over from that. So my playtesting style is different. My management style is different. I'm likelier to come up with a lot of ideas in a row, and I'll take ideas from games and put them into board games if I think they'll work. You know, just like when I did computer games, I would do the same thing because I always play board games. Mm-hmm. Mix match. And I think that if you have a board gamer designer that only does board games, he's missing out on some ideas from computer games. And similarly, if you have a computer designer who does computer games, he's missing out on cool things from board games. Here's an example. Neither of you have played Cthulhu Wars, I assume. Or have you?
I have not.
I haven't.
Games? Not yet? Okay. Mm. So I took something straight out of computer games for Cthulhu Wars, which is in the game, you have these spell books you're trying to earn. They're different for every faction, so Cthulhu has different spells from the Black Goat, right? But the way you earn them is on your faction sheet. You have these six tasks you have to do. When you complete a task, you take a spell book and put it there. It's just like an video game achievement.
Okay.
So you've achieved it. It never goes away. Like Cthulhu has to have three magical gates in the ocean. Once he does that, he gets an achievement. Okay, mm-hmm. And even if later on he loses his gates, doesn't matter. Got the achievement.
Yeah.
You know? And that is straight out of video games.
Yeah, instant gratification for completing a task.
Instant gratification and for a permanent result. It's really fun. Gives you and it has all these things like you're trying to do these bizarre things in the game that are not directly oriented towards like campaigning against other players. Because I gotta be in four different areas at once to get this. You're trying to do these. So all the factions are doing these weird things. That are different, and they feel different because they're trying to do it. Other players know they're doing it and say, hey, who's got to get four things? And they start interfering with it and kind of the board game element. But it's something I hadn't seen in computer games much or board games much. But computer games all do it, and there's one example. I have other ones, right? But that's an example of how it goes both ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a strong computer game legacy in my board game design. So.
Mm. Interesting. Now, one thing you mentioned a few minutes ago, Sandy, is the amount of time it takes to create a first draft of a tabletop game versus a digital game. And I guess going or continuing from that point of view, when you're thinking about a board game or even thinking about an expansion in one of your games, how's that thought process, I think, or I guess differ from when you're sitting around thinking, I want to make a new mechanic or I want to try designing a new digital game?
Well, one of the differences is that because I don't have an onboard playtest team for my board games, mm-hmm. for computer games, we had a bunch of guys whose only job was to playtest my games, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we'll do it whenever. But in board games, I have to, like, I have two or three board game nights a week that I go out and get them tested.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I have to wait for that. So sometimes I'm not getting testing information back as fast to modify the game as I want. So a game may still take a year to make but I'm doing multiple games at once. We're testing different ones. And the original design is only 2 or 3 months. If that makes sense to you, So one of the ways it differs is that in the computer game, I'll think of something. I'll like have this cool idea. Oh, I have this really great idea. Let's try this out. And then 6 weeks later, it's in the game to try out. And I've almost forgotten what I wanted it for. But in the board game, I'm sitting there saying, oh, I want this new boss. And literally 5 minutes later, I can have that boss in the game.
Yeah.
That is so great. And I still remember what I wanted to do with it, you know, which is huge.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to mention another thing I got from computer games. Mm-hmm. I recently released my Orcs Must Die board game.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there's a lot of computer games. There's a lot of board games which are cooperative, where everyone's on the same side, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of board games that are everyone against each other, where there's a whole bunch of different guys all fighting each other. Okay. But Orcs Must Die has another game way of doing things, which is very rare in board games, which is team-based. Each guy, they're like, there's an orc team and a human team, and they're against each other. So we have players who are cooperating with each other, but they're against the other team. And that's pretty common in computer games.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely becoming more common, too, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Every RTS game, a lot of shooters would have teams, but board games don't do it.
But I know.
That did that because I was imitating a feature in Orcs Must Die Unchained, which actually they dropped the feature, right?
Yeah.
But I still have it in my board game because
that's awesome.
Nice. Now, another part of the tale that we mentioned this earlier in the cast is the physical side of things, especially when it comes to logistics and manufacturing. And I asked this of Anthony when I spoke to him a few years ago, but I'm curious for you, Sandy. When you're designing your tabletop game, when do you start thinking about things in terms of a physical space sense? And
almost immediately, because for me to playtest my board game, I have to physically construct one.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually have to cut out cards, print out faction sheets, draw a game board with felt tip pens,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so there's this physical thing I'm making, you know. If I want to have monsters in the game, I got to get a figure from one of my other games and put it in there as a monster.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So right at the start, I'm thinking about physically what this is going to be like, mm-hmm. and how big it's going to be, and trying to get the board the right size and the figures are right. One of the differences in a computer game and a board game in this regard is that when I finally get everything figured out and all my art is done, which the art is at the end, unlike a computer game where it's during the process.
Yeah.
I mean, art in a computer game is finished long before you finish the programming, right?
Mm-hmm.
But my game, art's the last thing to do.
Yeah.
That's all done. Then it goes to China. Then they make the steel injection molds and they collate the games and they ship it on the slowest boat in the entire world to go across the ocean. Like, you know, that's how they do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally it gets to, then once they hit the port, they have to be transferred, right, all the slowness. Whereas in a computer game, if I finally finish it, it's on the shelves. Like, well, nowadays it's on Steam, right?
Yeah.
Even back in the day when MicroProse was doing a game, once it went gold, it was on shelves pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
So you finished up by the end of November. It was there, but it was, people could buy it for Christmas. You know, that's not true for me. If I finish the end of November, then it's not going to come out until, you know, the end of January.
Yeah.
And that's if I'm lucky, especially if Chinese New Year hits me.
Yeah.
Because now everything in China and Chinese New Year is like the worst thing. Talk to any board game designer and they will cuss out Chinese New Year.
Oh, really? Wow.
Oh yeah. We hate that. It's everyone in China is required to go on vacation for what amounts to a month. I mean, really, it's probably not really a month, but everyone kind of takes time. And they all go home to their home province and, I assume, or spend all the time drunk or something. And so every project is this giant delay, and the Chinese hardly ever plan for it. They say, oh, yeah, by the way, we're doing nothing for a month. Then when we get back, we'll have forgotten all of our skills.
Uh-huh.
Start again from scratch. Like, oh my gosh. So we just have to, like, so Chinese New Year is this huge thing we're constantly brooding about and swapping stories about at the bar at conventions and stuff. So you don't have that in digital games.
Yeah, definitely. Now, another part of the tabletop that I want to touch on before I get to, I guess, my big question for you, Sandy, is the idea of the expansions. And this is one of those things, as someone who sticks with digital games, is definitely something that I'm definitely out of my element on. Like, when I I'm looking at your Kickstarter for Cthulhu Wars, I was looking at the...
Like 25 expansions, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, the one for that Kingdom Monster game, they have, like, so many expansions. Like, that kind of idea of expanding your game out. Like, when we talk to traditional digital developers, when we think of expansions, we think of content that either will expand a game or will supplement what's there. And, you know, I could sit here and list expansions.
This went two different directions. Mm-hmm. I started out doing tabletop role-playing games, right? Well, for these, there's a million expansions. Most of the game is expansions. That's all the adventures you play,
mm-hmm.
right? So you have all these like the dwarf pack and the hero adventure and all this stuff. So if you get a role-playing game set, like the vast majority of publications for it are always expansions, right?
Yes.
So I go to Ensemble Studios eventually, and I work in there. We do Age of Empires 1, and I say, hey, you know what? Romans are really cool, and they're only a little bit after the time period of Age of Empires. Let's do an expansion called The Rise of Rome with some mm-hmm. Romans and some enemies for the Romans to fight. And Microsoft, who published us, said, oh, expansions don't sell. You shouldn't do it. So we did it on our own nickel. Right. and it was this tiny little thing. We only like five guys in the team. The rest were all working on the next project. And because expansions don't take as many people,
yeah.
So it was more like a board game almost. And we threw it together in 3 or 4 months. And so it only cost the company like $250,000, which for a digital game is like, you know, mm-hmm. you find that in your pocket change, you know. and then it went out and it sold like 350,000 copies or something. And so when we're doing now we're doing Age of Empires 2, right? And we finish it, and Microsoft comes and says, we know that expansions are a really good thing to do, and you always have to do it. It's like, yeah, who taught you? You know, they like didn't want to admit it, but like, of course, I did the Age of Kings for that. And a little funny word in that. So I'm doing the Age of Kings. I had four different civilizations for Age of Kings, right? Microsoft comes, it was called the Conquerors. So it was like the mm-hmm. Huns and the Aztecs and the Spanish, these conquering nations. And so Microsoft comes to us and they say, we want you to put the Koreans in it. We're going, the Koreans? And they say, yeah, we want you to have Koreans because Korea is this huge market and they sold three.
Yeah, we're trying to sell it to Korea. That's
yeah. So at first I said, well, Koreans aren't really a conqueror. They're great, but they're not a conquering nation. They said, but there was 3 million copies of StarCraft sold in Korea. I said, but StarCraft doesn't have Koreans. So StarCraft, they didn't care. So I had to throw together this whole expansion for the Koreans in like 5 weeks and get it in the game. And then it became like the most popular civilization, of course.
But oh, wow.
It was just like, that's kind of some of the give and take between the management but anyway, so they learned that expansions were good. And then when I went back into digital board games, I said, man, I love expansions. And the thing is, when you're doing your game on Kickstarter, then you have all these core guys who are super excited about your game. And one of the ways to keep them excited, as you know, are stretch goals.
Oh, yes.
Well, stretch goals naturally segue into doing expansions.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because you do a stretch goal and say, well, maybe we'll produce this thing. I have to make 4,000 minimum for the backers.
Yeah.
I'll have an expansion. Mm-hmm. You know? So that they kind of feed on each other, and that's why you have these games with these crazy numbers of expansions. Like Kingdom Death has 36 or 100 expansions. Who knows what it has? It has some huge number, right? And my game has 25 or something. All these games have these expansions, and that comes out of the nature of Kickstarter and the fact that you have this super fanatical core game that keeps thinking of these cool ideas to add to your game, and you're listening to them because you're responsive to your backers. So you're like, oh, that is a good idea. Let's add that. And then you throw it in, and then you can do it quickly. There's a fast turnaround because design is so fast in a board game. So overnight, I can come up with 8 new high priests for Call of Cthulhu or Cthulhu Wars and like start putting them in the game. And of course, they won't be balanced or anything, but...
Great. I guess here's my big question for you, Sandy, and then I'm going to turn it over to James, see if he has anything for you. But this is one of those questions I feel that this could either be a very long answer or a very short one. And, of course, it is. In your opinion, what do you think, I guess, makes a good board game or a good design of a tabletop game versus a poor one? Because, I mean, we can have discussions when it comes to digital games about what's good and bad until... you know, 30 days later kind of thing. But when it comes to designing a tabletop game, what are the experiences that, I guess, pull you in? And are there any elements that, I guess, push you away from a tabletop game?
I would say that the two elements that matter the most in a tabletop game are actually, to an extent, the same that make me like a digital game. Maybe it's just a game thing in general. And one of them is the look and feel and... tactile aspects of the game. one of the things about Cthulhu Wars that people say they like is pulling out that 8-inch tall Cthulhu and slamming them on the board. That has a feel that you don't get in most other games. Okay, there's that. There's the look of the game board. There's okay. One of the reasons that Age of Empires sold so well, I think, is because every other RTS game was some dark dystopic end of the world. You know what I mean?
Right? Yeah.
With this dark, spooky stuff. You look at Age of Empires and there's bright sunlight and birds flying to the trees and lions hunting impalas. And it looks, it's an attractive, inviting world. Now, of course, what you're doing is running around with your cavalry and massacring, you know, civilians. So it's a dark topic, but it doesn't look dark. It looks cheerful and nice. And so I kind of followed that in my game. It looks it like Cthulhu Wars is a bright colored game. So that's part of it. The other aspect is, and this is the mental aspect, which is I think a game is about interesting decisions that matter.
Yeah.
Okay? That's why we don't like Candyland anymore as adults. So we don't like Chutes and Ladders. We don't like Mouser. You're not making any decisions that matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay? You're making a few in Risk, but not many, and it takes so long to do it. Okay? Mm-hmm. And how many decisions do you make that matter in Monopoly? Right? There's talking your brother out of throwing the game board over when you place. That's about it. But you make an interesting decision and it makes a difference in the game. That's key to me, and that's what is true in Doom or Age of Empires or Cthulhu Wars or Ticket to Ride. Mm-hmm. Those are my two things.
Definitely, especially about interesting decisions, whether it's to keep a game from repetitive each time, or simply letting the player really, you know, feel like they're mattered in the game, like they're actually impacting the game.
I made a difference, even if you lose.
Yeah.
Okay. Which, if you play in a game that takes an hour or more to play, you better have fun even if you lose.
Yeah.
You better be able to go back and say, "Hey, remember that time I did this great thing? That was awesome. It almost worked." And they say, "Yeah, that was great."
Mm-hmm.
Create moments. Mm-hmm.
Yes. You have stories to tell about the game.
Definitely. And that's one of the things, like, tying us back into the strategy genre, that those stories became a very big part of things, especially with AARs, or after action reports, let's plays. When you're able to tie narratives to these games, it just really elevates things. And again, the fact that you can play a game five or six different times and have five or six completely different outcomes and how they're played really lend to that replayability and really makes a player feel like they're just not going through the motions, essentially, of this game.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we are over an hour, and again, if we're not careful, we'll be here for another 4 or 5, and I definitely want to touch more on Kickstarter. But before I do that, for you, James, do you have any questions for Sandy regarding tabletop design or implementation?
I have a whole nother cast worth of questions to ask Sandy about tabletop design. But actually, something I'm just going to keep kind of a simple one and take this how you want. And I remember you mentioned how, and I know, I guess, like, being a gamer all my life and growing up with, you know, playing board games and flipping tables over games like Monopoly and Parcheesi. But something I got to ask, and you don't see as much with a lot of the other Milton Bradley games, but how is Monopoly still around? Like, it's a bad game, and that makes people rage and anger. How is it that they can slap Pokemon on it, or Yu-Gi-Oh, or Game of Thrones, or
Star Wars,
or any franchise on Monopoly, and people are still, like, they can't be playing it. They have to be getting it for collection purposes only. Like, how does a game like Monopoly still survive when, like, a game like E.T., if somebody made it, tried to slap Star Wars and just gave us the same E.T. game from the Atari ages, we would laugh them, you know, out of existence.
It is a mystery to me that Monopoly, because it's so famous, people like it. If you go,
tradition,
yeah. So it's the safe thing to pick. Like, if you go, there's a site called Board Game Geek, okay, and if you go there, and they have a database of 90,000 board games, okay. And they're all rated by the geeks from number one to the last one on the list, right? So Monopoly is, of course, on this list. And I am actually looking for even right at this moment to see where it stands. Cthulhu Wars, by the way, I think is 220. So I thought it was pretty good for.
I'm not complaining,
right? But it's weighted so that if you're there we go. Okay, so Monopoly is number 13,000 on the list, which is not good.
Wow.
Okay. It has a rating of 4.3 out of 10, which I think is probably about what it deserves.
Yeah, that, mm-hmm. I think three of those points are for nostalgia and for nostalgia purposes only. Like,
and all the Monopolies are in the same category, you know, right? But but like the games at the very bottom are the very lowest games are stuff like Candyland and Chutes and Ladders and Tic-Tac-Toe. Operation is down there because
Sorry down there too.
Sorry, I don't know. Well, let's see where Sorry. I can look where Sorry is. I mean, it's
Sorry is bad. Sorry is so broke.
No, I agree. Sorry is 13,224. It has a slightly higher rating than Monopoly, 4.6 instead of 4.3. I guess there's more decisions you make in Sorry than in Monopoly. You have a decision to make, which it's always obvious what the correct decision is, right?
Huh. Weird.
But that's a good way of seeing what board gamers think of a game. If you go to Board Game Geek and just type in the name of the game you want and see what the board game rank is, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of course, there is a little bit of skews on the very top because the games at the very top or whatever games are really popular at the moment, and that might change in a month. But.
Mm-hmm. All right. Do you have any other questions for Sandy James?
Tons, but we don't have the time. So.
Yeah. I think we may have to turn this into a part two cast at some point to focus more on Cthulhu Wars because. Yeah. There, if we start talking about that again, we are approaching, we've been talking for about an hour and a half, a little less than that in terms of recording, but yeah, I can feel this being one of those epically long casts if we're not too careful.
Yeah, no, we definitely would love to have you on again. Like I said, it's been a real honor to have you on, Sandy.
Yeah. Well, sure, anytime.
Now, before we get to the final topic, at least for this cast, we're talking more about Kickstarter and its impact on tabletop games. There's one other question I want to run by you, Sandy. This is one that I was talking about on the live discussion we had a few last week, of course, several weeks ago, for those of you listening to this. And that is one of the challenges, especially with tabletop games, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, regarding the physical presence that they have. Again, that feeling again when you put Cthulhu down on a table or you have this impressive board laid out. That is a major element of tabletop games, but it's also one of the things that kind of limits it in a sense, especially for people who don't have the room. When I was talking on our live discussion, we were talking about Warhammer and the miniatures market. And basically looking at that stuff, I know I will never have enough room to run anything of that in this house. And one of the things that was kind of interesting is...
Well, Warhammer can take an infinite amount of space, right? Yes. You can just keep expanding it, so it's... Yeah.
And the other part that is special with tabletop games is, again, the setup. When you have to, again, you need multiple people to play. And one of the things that we've seen, especially in recent years, especially with digital games, is how they've managed to streamline a lot of the complexities out. I mean, we have an entire conversation about CRPGs and streamlining D&D rules. And I guess for my question for you, Sandy, is one of the things that I was seeing lately is with the game Tabletop Simulator, which, for those of you who don't know, it's basically a platform that lets you play tabletop games. It has an entire physics engine built in so you can simulate rolling dice, moving figures around, etc. And my question is, when it comes to the tabletop genre, again, with that amount of setup that's there, do you think that we will see, I guess, more of a transition to digital when it comes to these usually physically demanding tabletop games?
I think that board game companies will be keenly interested in expanding into the digital market every chance they have.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, most of them have less experience in it than I do.
Yeah.
But I've already had people want to do Cthulhu Wars digitally and things like that. I mean, if you can hold off, it's still to me, there's still a certain element of having the guy right there that I can make fun of.
Yeah.
But other things you do just being like, you can do the have your monsters move around instead of just and be animate instead of just sitting there, which is always better. I do remember seeing a board game in a virtual reality thing where I was up visiting my buddy Paul Bettner. He gave me one of the most advanced, like not yet produced virtual reality, and there was a board game you'd play where you'd move things around with your controller when you had the helmet on. Mm-hmm. And it was cool to see that in there working. But then you have the thing where to do this, the board game has to already exist, right?
Yeah.
So someone has to make the board game because the simulator probably will take more time to put together and mimic the game than it took to do the board game in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely. Especially since the simulator or the digital game has to process all the rules and all the systems on the back end.
Yeah, and then you have to do all the art for it, which you can't use the art you already did for the board. Well, you can use some of it to the art you can use, but not, you know, maybe, but it's harder to use the art. If you want it to animate, you have to animations, you have to have a control system. There's all this stuff you're doing, and so suddenly you're basically doing a board game and you're doing a computer game. And I have one of the things I try to do in my company is people are constantly trying to get me to do to sneak back into the world of computer games. And I'm like, look, you know, I cannot do board games and computer games. Mm-hmm. That's just not going to happen. And I've made my choice. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If I ever decide to go back into computer games, it'll probably be because Peterson Games, the board game company, has failed. And then I just like dust off the resume and go looking for a job. Right. Mm-hmm. But, I'm perfectly happy for someone else doing it for me and then paying money. But I don't want to be heavily involved in it because if I do Cthulhu Wars and then I'm spending another year doing Cthulhu Wars for Steam, that's a year that I could have done four other board games.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, I think with that said, again, I know for those of you listening, we're not going to be touching too much on the design Cthulhu Wars here because, again, we'll be here for another who knows how many hours. But for our final topic for tonight, I want to touch on, as we were saying earlier, how crowdfunding has really impacted the tabletop industry. We mentioned a few minutes ago with the game, that Kingdom board game that earned... Well, do you know what they actually ended with? Because I think they were at just about 10 million or close to it when I checked, like, with 44 hours left.
Let me look right now. And it is 12,300,000. And it is, I think it's over now.
Oh, it better be over. I think it was at, like, just under, like, 2 days or, like, little over 2 days when we were talking.
A lot of your money comes in the last 2 days.
Yeah.
This one didn't quite get, like, with the games I do, it's been about a third in the first 2 days and then about a third in the last 2 days. And I think that was like 20% in the last few days. So not quite as good there, but better on the front. Of course, the whole amount of 12 million. Yeah, you'd see they now have 19,000 people.
Oof.
So the last 2,000 people they got added just $2 million. So that's actually less than... they did with the previous backers. But here's the thing. It's not over yet for them because I guarantee they're going to have people doing like backing it after, you know, getting late pledges and until they finalize the production run.
Yeah.
We can still add money to them. So like my last thing I did, which was I did this for Cthulhu Wars. It made like $1 million, I think, online, but then it made another $1 million in late pledges, so that was visible on the Kickstarter. Now, of course, that's, you know, a tenth or less than a tenth as much as they made, but still, you know, I was happy with it.
Yep, definitely. So, for this topic, then, as we were just saying, when it comes to Kickstarter and crowdfunding, we've certainly seen, in terms of the digital side, there was the boom in about 2012, 2013 with Broken Age, Double Fine. And that kind of led into a few years where, when it came to digital games, that it seemed like everyone was getting funded. Like, anyone who wanted to pitch either a passion project or remake a classic game, that chances are it was going to succeed on Kickstarter. Now, over, like, the last, I guess we could say maybe 2 years, maybe a little bit more than that, we've seen things have simmered down in a sense. It's becoming a little bit harder to get those ideas pitched. You really need to plan things out. And even then, you may not get the funding that you're looking for. But
you now you have to have a game that's much more polished than you used to. And also people have been burned by failed projects, particularly video game projects, which have bigger obstacles to overcome than board games.
Yes.
So hit the obstacle off, they can't deliver. And then it's like, if you look at the list of big failed Kickstarter projects, a large percentage are digital.
Yeah, definitely. And again, that is easily another topic in it itself we could talk about. But the one area that seems to have still flourished and is still going strong, as we just said, is the tabletop one. Like, it seems like whenever I go on Kickstarter and I type for a new tabletop game or someone mentions it, when I go on that Kickstarter, not only does it meet its funding goal, but it goes well, well over it. And it, for again, for someone who's mainly stuck with digital games, this is just shocking to me to see like how well it's doing.
Oh, so, it's not shocking to me at all. Like, yeah. Like a lot of, I know a lot of people who aren't into digital who are really been kicking up to the board coming back to board games and the new like you said, the whole German era of board gaming where things are. You know, with the new, like things like Settlers of Catan, you know what I mean? They're just making a really big splash nowadays.
Yeah, well, I would say that, I mean, the thing is that, how was I going to put this? My whole business model is based on me selling more than the minimum to do my games, right? And going on Kickstarter and having them produce it. So when I go on Kickstarter and Kickstarter doesn't back a game, I don't make a smaller print run. I don't do it at all. It's just not okay. Not on the radar. Do something else. But also I try to make over time. My Kickstarters have been more and more successful as a percentage, where I don't have as many failed ones anymore. And I think and but this feeds on itself because as you start making successful Kickstarter things, say you're looking at an interesting board game, you go on Kickstarter and there's two games that both look interesting, but one of them is by a stuff that has produced games and delivered and people like the other things he's done, the other is by someone brand new. Well, I mean, you might still want to back the guy who's brand new, but odds are you're going to go for the established person. Plus, you're likely to have heard about the established person.
Yeah.
This James here comes to you and says, oh my gosh, you got to see this guy's latest game. I love his other games. This is going to be great too, I'm sure. And you don't have that for the new people. So it's starting to, so while Kickstarter was originally made to boost brand new guys out of the starting slots, and it still does that. Now there's people that are like, I have this entire company and now I'm kind of an established company, but every game is on Kickstarter. You know, to feel out the people, see what they want, all the advantages that it gives me are not to be dismissed.
And I guess keeping with that, especially, I guess this question will be for both of you guys then. When it comes, again, to the fact that it seems like it is more, like when it comes to tabletop versus digital in terms of the Kickstarter, that there is, seems to be a lot more trust in the tabletop side of things. I guess my question then, in both of your opinions, when it comes to like these successes, like again, I'm looking at like Cthulhu Wars. I was looking at the Kingdom game, and like as someone from the outside, it just looks like when you see like this entire list of possible expansions, all the things that you get with it, it just boggles my mind. But for people who are fans of tabletop games, like is this stuff just like almost like a second nature in a sense? Like it's just like, you know, another day like looking at a tabletop game when you see like, you know, all these possible expansions and everything that you get with it.
Well, I hope they don't burn out on it, you know. I mean, one of the things that you have, if you have a system they like that they're kind of invested in and they want to get more stuff for it, then it's exciting to see that stuff. And a lot of it's free when you back on Kickstarter, or at least cheaper.
Yeah.
And one of the advantages is even though I do these giant, massive overproduced games, which take longer to get out than the average game, which is a thing we're trying really hard to solve. but I still get it out faster than a video game does. You know, and there are companies that have tried to do things, and I'm not talking about video games, but about board games, who like change their names and put it because there's a history. People say, oh yeah, these guys, they did this big flop that cheated the fans. Mm-hmm. Let's do about it. And you can see this in the video games even more because it's harder for them to change their names and hide because they're a bigger company. So you have like Yogg Ventures, which was completely canceled. And there's $500,000 people dropped on that. And they're just never going to get back.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, and there's, remember Clang?
Yeah.
Another $500 million that that one actually came out, but then it like it wasn't what they thought it would be. And there's the Ouya, which was a console. That was the biggest success ever on Kickstarter for a while. It was $8 million. And then, you know, the company went out of business. Razer bought it. Who knows what Razer will do, right? But if you invested in that thing 3 years ago, then again, you, like, your money was dropped, and then you're going to be suspicious of new video game projects, which is probably why video games have a lower success rate than the board games. Just like I said, I'm not saying it's the fault of the guys that did these games that they failed. There's so many things, roadblocks, that come up when you're doing a digital game. Your lead programmer gets hired away to work at Blizzard. You know, I mean, this is – I don't have lead programmers to get hired away, right? I can have my artist or my producer hired away, but they're frankly easier to replace in a board game industry. You know? So,
on the consumer side of things, I definitely one of my favorite games is it's not a board game per se, but it's actually a tabletop card game called Smash Up. And Smash Up has I love Smash Up. It's so good. Yeah, definitely. The when you get people that really and full wholeheartedly enjoy a game, which it's not that hard to find at least one or two board games that somebody's going to really, really enjoy. Now you take that and multiply it by a couple of, you know, million people, you're gonna, the second somebody that investment in doing, hey, we have a bunch of people that are buying our game. Let's see what they want. Let's give them more. You know what I mean? And a lot of the things with expansions is the base play doesn't change. So if the base play doesn't change, it's one of those things in Smash Up, if you were playing with aliens and robots and someone's like, hey, what, Cthulhu? And we're like, So, you know, I mean, even though we're having Cthulhu as an expansion, the base gameplay hasn't changed. So the entry level hasn't really, you know, I think in Cthulhu they did make a couple of new game rules, now madness cards and stuff. But generally speaking, the base gameplay doesn't change. So people can still jump right in and learn something new. The players that have already been playing can take their decks and maximize it or take their expansion and have a blast doing something new. And generally speaking, expansions aren't going to cost you as much, which is great marketing because I can go, I think in the original Smash Up expansion is $40, but every expansion or the original Smash Up is $40, but every expansion you get is only $20. So you're like, oh, sweet, I'm getting a deal. I mean, you're getting
it's way cheaper than Food Wars. Yeah. Right.
Yep.
But no, the fact is, the thing is, because you can do a computer game, a video, or a tabletop game so much more quickly than a computer game, and because you have to have less investment in money, so smaller, weirder guys can put them together, there is vastly more variety in tabletop games than there is in computer games. So if you want to play a tabletop game that takes 10 minutes to play and is really fun and just involves throwing dice and cussing out your opponents, you can get King of Tokyo and you're in.
Yep.
You know, if you want to play a tabletop game that takes a couple hours to play and has all this massive Tetris-like strategy, you can get Feast of Odin and you're there. But the variety in tabletop games is so much bigger than computer games that I think that's part of the attraction. There really is a game out there that you'd really like.
Yeah. Yep.
Cool. Now, getting back to the topic with crowdfunding, especially when it comes to the tabletop market, as we were saying earlier in the cast regarding, again, the demands of physical goods and the logistics that can go into that, I guess for you, Sandy, we mentioned this earlier, that when you start thinking about a tabletop game, you're basically thinking about the physical design or the physical constraints from day one. When it comes to putting together your Kickstarter, I guess, are there any major red flags or things for developers listening to watch out for when they're going about, I guess, planning things if they want to do their own tabletop-based Kickstarter or crowdfunding project?
Are you talking like for a fan who's looking at the game to see if it's going to succeed or not? Or
More from like a design point, I feel like. Let's say someone wants to go on Kickstarter with their own idea.
Well, originally you could do it with a bunch of concept art and some sketches. Now it's getting more and more that people want to see that you have a solid, like, semi-complete game, which means it actually is a bigger buy-in than there used to be. It's still trivial compared to a computer game. Like for us, our goal now is for all our future Kickstarters that we want to actually have full 3D models or sometimes already sculpted models of the game, at least one of each, so you can see what the models really look like. before you buy. So we're doing that now. Used to be you could do concept art. Another thing that is a consideration that is really important is that the one of the features in Kickstarter is that is like if you've delivered on your previous project. So say that you've given me like, you know, $200 for my latest Cthulhu Wars or Orcs Must Die. Well, you may not want to invest in my next Kickstarter until I've delivered on the previous one. You know, so I have to delay my Kickstarter until I've shipped on that, unless I'm shipping so regularly that everyone like, oh yeah, they always ship. I'm not going to worry about it. But this actually hurt a Kickstarter I did last year, where I had another Kickstarter that hadn't quite shipped, and people noticed, and then they were like kind of waiting to hang on to the new one, and so my new Kickstarter deservedly did worse because they were kind of saying that you have a lot of Kickstarters that haven't shipped yet. I think I had three outstanding ones. And I did this other Kickstarter, and I said, okay, learn my lesson. Not going to do that anymore. I'm going to have fewer outstanding Kickstarters when I do my thing. So I'll have already delivered. They'll have the other toys. They'll be able to play with them, you know. So I got to ship it. I got to deliver it. I got to have the game have a better prototype so when they see it, they can do it. A lot of times people now want to have a print-and-play version of the game to try it out before they play it, you know, and I'll provide that. At least I'll give them a copy of the rules to look over. You know, so it may not be final edit with all the illustrations, but they'll see the rules. So there's a lot of, I'm trying to give them as much stuff upfront as possible so that they're getting, they understand what the experience will be for what they're investing their money in.
All right. And I'm glad that you mentioned about people backing like multiple projects. So that was one of the other major points I wanted to ask you about, Sandy. When we look at things, when we look at like digital crowdfunding and digital Kickstarter projects, it's very rare or it's very risky for the same developer to make, you know, two or three different Kickstarter projects for different games. As we were saying, when like the reputation of the developer can sometimes or most of the time can make or break subsequent Kickstarters. But with board games, as you're saying, with your company and your strategy, basically, it's going to be crowdfunding or bust, essentially. If your game doesn't meet its crowdfunding goal, it's not going to get made. And I guess, in your opinion, Sandy, and if you want to add anything to James, feel free, why do you think the tabletop genre or tabletop companies are, I guess, given more of a wider range when it comes to saying, like, basing each one of their tabletop games on crowdfunding as opposed to the digital market, where it seems more riskier to do things along that line?
Can you reword the question?
I guess
it's kind of a lengthy question.
I know.
are you asking why it seems more of a risk to put to do crowdfunding for video games than it does for tabletop?
There's more risk for doing video games than tabletop because it takes longer to produce the game, and people are aware of that. It takes a bigger team to produce the game, and people are aware of that. And even for a small video game, it takes more money to produce it. Like I was looking recently at like big failures on video games for Kickstarter. Well, one of them was a game that made $114,000. I was like, what kind of video game can you do for 114 grand? Yeah. Obviously, that's going to fail. Okay. But I can do a pretty stellar board game for $40,000 to $50,000. That's plenty of money to do a board game.
Yeah.
You know? And so I need less money to do a good quality job. I don't have to have a team of artists and programmers and designers working for a year on this thing. You know, I have me doing it. Really part-time for a year or more. I have my free playtesters. I have an artist, you know. The artist probably isn't full-time on my game. And so it's cheaper to put it out. I can get it to audience faster than the video game, where I may have to wait for, you know, a year and a half to get it produced because video games take a long time. And a thing that plays off it is that video games have, on Kickstarter, done worse, partly for these reasons, and therefore they have a worse reputation.
All right. And I think I just thought of how I could rephrase the question. Why do you think like tabletop fans are more willing to essentially keep donating to a single company when they're putting out multiple crowdfunding-based tabletop games versus that kind of fatigue that settles in if a digital developer wanted to just keep making games via Kickstarter, regardless of the, you know, the amount of funding they received from the previous game?
Let me answer it this way. During my 10 or 11 years I spent at Ensemble Studios, we produced 5 games. Okay, these are all big hit games. Yeah. Age of Empires 1, 2, 3, Age of Mythology, and Halo Wars. Fabulous selling games, but there was 5 in 11 years. I have produced that many games in my little tiny board game company already in the last couple years, plus way more expansions. So my fans have Ensemble Studio had fans, obviously, who loved it and looked forward to the next game, but I have had a lot more cycles of production for them to see what I'm like, to see what my games are like, and because I'm doing a Kickstarter, I'm responding, I'm talking personally to these guys. I go into the comments column and say things to them. I know their names in many cases. Ensemble Studios, I didn't know the names of any of my fans. You know, and so they know who I am. They see me. I'll do games while I talk. I can go on the updates and do personal things. Like I had one article about my support system that lets me do games. And it's basically my wife, right? I said, she puts up with all these things. And she's like, when I wanted to want to quit my job and do board games for a year, she lets me. And we're 60 years old. It's nuts, right? Shouldn't you want security? But she lets me do this, right? And so that kind of see, read that. They like it. When I tell them on the Kickstarter thing, which I have, I said, I'm going to make sure this thing delivers if I have to mortgage my house to do it. And I did. And they remember that. And you don't see that happening with a digital company.
You almost can't see that happen. You can't see that happening with a digital company. It's almost like,
these guys think of themselves as my friends. And of course it has drawbacks as well, because I'll show up at a convention and someone like, he feels he knows me. And I've seen him, you know, he'll walk up and be buddy. I respond, you know, in a friendly way, but I don't always know who they are. Especially since, of course, online they have some weird handle and it's not their real name.
All right. Again, we are over an hour and a half in. I mean, I think we can both just sit here and talk.
Another time if you want. But
I guess to wrap things up, I'm just about out of questions regarding Kickstarter and tabletop. For you, James, do you have anything you want to ask Sandy about regarding the tabletop market in crowdfunding?
No, it's just one of those things I really think that we're going to see. I really just hope that that crowdfunding and tabletop still stay strong together, because I think it's going to be a way to get out a lot of content, which is going to give people a lot of options and a lot of choices for a lot of cool games.
Right? Yeah. Crowdfunding is here to stay.
Yeah.
All right. Let's wrap things up here. Again, it has been a huge pleasure having you on, Sandy. I mean, again, so many of our topics we could easily dedicate into entire casts like it was nothing.
Well, yeah, it's true. Well, you know, like I said, I've simply through longevity, I've accrued a lot of stories and stuff. So it's like, for better or worse.
My dad always says, I'm old findings.
I'm sorry, you kind of broke in out there, James.
I said, my dad always says, I'm old, so I know things.
Well, you know, that's actually, you know, you may not be wise, but at least you have experience, you know?
All right. And like I said, it will be great to have you on for a live discussion. Again, there's so much we left, I guess, off the table that we can easily dedicate to. And maybe by the time for you folks listening to this recorded, we may have set something up live by then.
Okay. That'll be cool.
All right. So for everyone listening, we're going to end the cast here again. We could easily do a part 2 and maybe even a part 3. I think that could easily be fit in with everything we've left off. But again, Sandy, thank you so much for coming onto the cast. I wish you the best of luck with your company. And I guess to end things on, for people listening, are you working on any new or upcoming tabletop games as we're doing this recording or as we're speaking?
It is literally 90% of my job description to do that. So, yes, I have. I mentioned that I've worked on 4 games at this time. I'm working on a sequel to Orcs Must Die. I'm working on a sequel to Cthulhu Wars. I'm working on a new game with my son called Evil High Priest, which is a work replacement game where you play head of an evil cult. And I'm working on a Space 4X game.
Cool. So, and if there's some way we can do it, I would love to be able to like play these games and show it off. I just don't know how I can do that with my setup here.
I almost forgot. I'm also working on a full-on board game about the apocalypse.
Nice. A family-friendly topic there, you know, for the whole family there.
It's kind of apocalypse for the whole family.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. Why not, right?
All right. So with that said, James, again, thank you for coming on. I'm sure you're geeking out as much as I am talking to Sandy.
Definitely.
All right. So for those of you listening, we're going to end things here. As always, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom and what we do, there are multiple ways of doing that. If you'd like to be a guest for a future podcast or for one of our live shows, be sure to get in touch. You can find information and links under Submissions Wanted. We are always looking for new people to talk to or to even write a guest piece for the site. Be sure to follow me on Twitch and Twitter under GW Bicer for the latest updates of new content and random thoughts. Check out the Game Wisdom YouTube channel, now in 2017 and over 1,000 subscribers strong. You can find daily videos looking at video games, as well as design topics in my vlog series, A Critical Thought. And to support Game Wisdom's Patreon campaign, you can find us on there under Game Wisdom. Donations will be greatly appreciated in order to allow us to support the site and everything we do. And if we can hit some goals, it will mean adding more content for everyone to enjoy. So, once again, thank you so much for listening to this cast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Have a great night.